I'm going to try and keep this relatively brief. So let me just go straight to talk about Abraham. Think about this man. God had chosen to be the one through whose family he would bring salvation into the world. He would bring a savior into the world through this man, make all these wonderful promises, and through his seed bless all the families of the earth. Now, what did God do when he first chose this man? Look with me in Acts chapter 7 as Stephen recounts what God had done when he called Abraham. Acts chapter 7 verse 2, he said, "Hear me, brethren and fathers. The glory of God appeared to our father Abraham when he was in Mesopotamia, before he lived in Haran, and said to him, 'Depart from your country and your relatives, and come into the land that I will show you.'" You see, what God did when he called the father of our faith was turn him into a pilgrim. He turned him into a pilgrim and called him out of his land. He confessed that he was a pilgrim, Genesis 23, verse 4. We live the same way as pilgrims in this world. We inherit his lifestyle. This is really an important quality that we should have as Christians. This is what we're going to be talking about today, is living as pilgrims. That's going to affect the way that we live, which of course affects our destiny as well. Now think about Abraham, starting in chapter 12 of the book of Genesis. Most of the time we'll be staying in the book of Genesis. Genesis chapter 12. And we're going to consider how Abraham's example and then a contrasting example will affect the way that we live as we strive to imitate the faith of Abraham. Abraham was not a perfect man in any way, but taken as a whole, his life showed remarkable faith as he made the choice again and again to follow God, even though these were things that were unseen. I mean, think about the promises that God made to Abraham in Genesis chapter 12. He made three promises, as we typically break them down. Genesis chapter 12, verse 1, the Lord said to Abraham, "Go forth from your country and from your relatives, from your father's house, to the land which I will show you." Now, had he ever seen that land? No. Then he says, "And I will make you a great nation." "I'll make you a great nation" is the second promise. Is that something he would ever see? No, because it was always going to be farther down in the future that he would never be able to see it. And he says, "And I will bless you and make your name great." Now, in fact, nobody would be able to see such a thing as a blessing, because a blessing is an intangible thing. So on these promises, which required faith from Abraham, he left his home, his kindred, his father's house, all in response to God's call. Now, if you don't want to go back and forth, you can stay in Genesis, but I'm going to read a few verses in Hebrews chapter 11, which describes Abraham's faith, starting at verse 8. "By faith, Abraham, when he was called, obeyed by going out to a place which he was to receive for an inheritance. And he went out, not knowing where he was going. By faith, he lived as an alien." We might say as a foreigner, right? "In a land of promise, as in a foreign land, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, fellow heirs of the same promise. For he was looking for the city which has foundations, whose architect and builder is God." So notice how often it says in this text it was by faith, verses 8 and 9. He looked forward, verse 10. He was looking, right? So he was looking forward by faith. He was not looking around by sight. So there's really no earthly reason to go. An earthly observer would look at him and say, "Why are you doing these things? It makes no sense." And that's the kind of faith that we want to have. We want to have a life that couldn't possibly make sense to people around us. So if a worldly person could understand at every step in our lives why it is we are taking the steps we are taking, we're not living by faith, are we? We're living just as they are, by sight. A person who lives by faith is going to disdain earthly rewards and instead trust in God. Now, this choice that he had to renounce everything, Abraham is going to make repeatedly and throughout his life. Look, for instance, in chapter 13 of Genesis. What happens is that in Canaan, there is actually a shortage of pasture land for the immense flocks and herds that Abraham and his nephew Lot have. So they have to separate there in Genesis 13. Now, Abraham generously gives the first choice of direction to go to his nephew Lot. And Lot, what did he do? Well, Lot lifted up his eyes, says verse 10. Okay, Lot lifted up his eyes. And I'm emphasizing that because you see someone here who is walking by sight. He lifted up his eyes and he saw all the valley of the Jordan, that it was well watered everywhere. This was before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. "Like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt, as far as you go to Zoar." Now, he decided, that's the place for me. that well-watered land, that green pasture land, that's the place that I'm going to make my home, because he was choosing the things that are seen. Abraham, on the other hand, was walking by faith, not by sight, and he's going to continue his wandering lifestyle. And you start to see the results immediately. Now, Abraham, in a positive way, if you look at verse 14, the Lord said to Abraham, after Lot had separated from him, "Now lift up your eyes." So this is a divine invitation now to lift up his eyes and see the blessing that God has for him. "Look from the place where you are, northward and southward and eastward and westward, for all the land which you see I will give to you and to your descendants forever." You see a renewal of the promises that God had given to Abraham as God saw his faith to continue his pilgrimage lifestyle, and God is going to bless him. However, the next thing you read about Lot is going to be very different, because the material things that were the overriding factor in his choices in life are going to prove to be terribly insecure. As you get to the next chapter in Genesis 14, what happens is that this place that he has chosen to live by, Sodom, becomes embroiled in this huge international conflict. It's like four kings versus five, these city-states. So if you look in verses 8 through 12, I believe, in Genesis 14, you're going to see all this huge battle that was going on between these kings. And in the middle of it is the king of Sodom and the king of Gomorrah, mentioned in verse 8. So, in fact, verse 10, the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah flee. They lose this battle. The survivors flee into the hill country. Then look at verse 11. They took all the goods of Sodom and Gomorrah and all their food supply and departed. Now, of course, that's what was the overriding factor in Lot's life, was all those goods and all those food supply, all that that valley had. And yet, the next time you read about it, up and gone in a flash. "They also took Lot," verse 12, Abram's nephew, "and his possessions and departed, for he was living in Sodom." So all those possessions that he treasured so much, up and gone. They're carried away by these invaders. So now Abraham has to make another choice of faith. And when he hears about Lot, who has been taken away with all of his possessions and his family, Abraham's choice of faith is going to be to go after the victorious army who had taken away all these goods and booty and slaves. And he is going to go after them with merely the men that are in his house. There's 318 of his servants in his household. He's kind of the original Gideon, right? Gideon took his 300 men and fought against a huge army. Abraham takes that many men, attacks a victorious army who had conquered already if five different kings, and he recovers the people and the spoil of Sodom. Now, here's another choice of faith as he comes back from this victory. In verse 17, look what happens. This is Genesis 14, verse 17. "After his return from the defeat of Chedorlaomer and the kings who were with him, the king of Sodom went out to meet him." Now, remember, it's not the king of Sodom who has won the victory. This is Abraham's return from defeating Chedorlaomer and the kings. But the king of Sodom comes out to meet him. Clearly, the king of Sodom has been one of the survivors who went fleeing. Well, he comes out to meet him at the Valley of Shavi, that is the king's valley. Now, what you've got here is the king of Sodom, Bera, according to verse 2. But he's not the only one, and I'm summarizing some of this for the sake of time. He's not the only one that comes out to meet Abraham after Abraham returns from the victory. There is also a man named Melchizedek. Melchizedek was a king of Salem, another city, later known as Jerusalem. So he is a king of Salem, but he's also recognized in this text as a priest of God. So two very different men representing two very different ways of life, two very different possibilities of alliances come out to meet Abraham. And so what you've got here is the same crisis of faith. Which are you going to choose, Abraham? With whom are you going to make an alliance? Now, here's what the king of Sodom offers him in verse 21. The king of Sodom said to Abraham, "Give the people to me and take the goods for yourself." So the king of Sodom does what the king of Sodom always does. He offers stuff, possessions. And this is kind of like a little bit of a foretaste of, if you keep your alliance with me, continue to live in this place, you're going to get a lot more of this. This is kind of a down payment. You will have a future lucrative business relationship. Maybe you could even have a permanent home here. And that might have sounded tempting to someone who'd been living in tents for years. The only trouble is that you'd have to interact on a consistent basis with men who are exceedingly wicked sinners, as we find out In chapter 13, verse 13, the men of Sodom were wicked exceedingly and sinners against the Lord. So that's the compromise you're going to have to make, but you'll get all the stuff. Well, Melchizedek, the priest of God, when he comes to Abraham, he doesn't offer any escape for him from the life of pilgrimage. Tell you what he offers. He offers the name of God, and he offers the blessing of God. This is in verse 18. Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. Now he was priest of God Most High. And he blessed him and said, "Blessed be Abram of God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, and blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand." So he blesses Abraham in the name of the Most High God. Now that's a great reminder that Abraham needed as he was making that choice of faith or not, of pilgrimage or not. Because there is no higher God than the Lord. What belongs to him? He is possessor of heaven and earth. Now that enemy that Abraham had defeated was a strong enemy. It had already conquered five kings. Abraham was in a far off land. He only had 318 men with him, and yet God had delivered that army into his servant Abraham's hands. So this blessing for the Most High God is worth more than all the riches of Sodom. More than Sodom would ever be able to pay. So Abraham does this in verse 22. Abraham said to the king of Sodom, "I have sworn to the Lord God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, that I will not take a thread or a sandal thong or anything that is yours, lest you should say, I have made Abram rich." He refused to take even the smallest bait from the hand of the king of Sodom. Now, that's very different from Lot, isn't it? Abraham considered with faith that it is better to possess the favor of the one who possesses it all than to trust in earthly riches. Earthly riches, if Lot has not yet found it out, if you in your life have not yet found it out, can be taken away in an instant. How many reminders do we need just how quickly earthly riches can be taken from us? Now, the next verse after this chapter shows how God felt when Abraham had taken the step of faith, because he reaffirms these promises. Chapter 15, verse 1, "After these things, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision, saying, 'Do not fear, Abram. I am a shield to you. Your reward shall be very great.'" He had made a step of faith, and the reward that the Lord will give him in his favor is very great. And the story of Lot doesn't end here. You'd think that Lot would get the message. But Lot persists in living in Sodom. Because the next time you see him is not in a tent in Sodom. It's in his very gate. You see that this crisis for Lot was not going to be a passing problem. That's the way people of the world think it when they have economic problems or their riches are taken away. It's just a bump in the road. Let me keep persisting in my lifestyle of seeking these things because ultimately it'll work out well for me. But things are going to get worse for Lot. And the long-term results are going to be even more disastrous. Let's talk a little bit about Sodom. You remember that verse we read in chapter 13, verse 10. Says that Lot lifted up his eyes, saw all the valley of the Jordan, that it was well watered everywhere. Now, apparently that would be a shock to the readers of this text, because they would know that that valley is not well watered. It is not like a garden. And the text has to make an explanation. This was before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. So that wasteland that we know, that's not the way it always was. So the reader is warned that Sodom is going to get destroyed. Abram also gets a warning from God. If we jump a few chapters ahead to chapter 18, Abram in chapter 18, verses 20 and 21, is told by some angelic messengers that the Lord said the outcry of Sodom and Gomorrah is indeed great. Their sin is exceedingly grave. I will go down now and see if they have done entirely according to its outcry, which has come to me, and if not, I will know. So the Lord's scouts are going there, and they're going to find out if it is quite as bad as the Lord knows it to be. And if it is that bad, well, I think we know what is going to happen. Now, Abraham had already saved Sodom. The city owed its continued existence to Abraham because of what Abraham did when he went and defeated their enemies. So that was a rescue operation once. Now Abraham is going to embark on another rescue operation. This time it's going to be through intercession, because he is going to try and prevent the Lord from destroying Sodom, who is full of exceedingly wicked people. So he intercedes here. This is a long section in this chapter, second half of chapter 18. We're not going to read it. I just want to point out a few of these verses. Listen to the way Abraham talks as he says, God, if there's a certain amount of people that are righteous in this city, will you spare the city for the sake of the righteous? Listen how Abraham talks in verse 27. Abraham answered and said, now behold, I have ventured to speak to the Lord, though I am but dust and ashes. And he gets the Lord to agree, 50 righteous people, and the Lord will spare the city. Look at the way he talks in verse 30. Oh, may the Lord not be angry, and I shall speak. Suppose 30 are found. Verse 31, now behold, I have ventured to speak to the Lord. Suppose 20 are there. Verse 32, then he said, oh, may the Lord not be angry, and I shall speak only this once. Suppose 10 are found there. So, it's interesting how the number keeps dropping, and the Lord in His mercy accepts those numbers. But I just want you to see how careful Abraham was in his speech with the Lord. He recognized that there was a greater danger here than there was even when there was an army of men coming against Sodom. He recognized that the Lord's wrath was against Sodom. So he was more hesitant and fearful than when he chased after an army with only 318 men. So God agrees to this for 10 people. Now, forget 318. God's willing to spare Sodom for just an army of 10. Just an army of 10 righteous people will be what spares Sodom. The question is, will they be found there? Will they be found, even 10 people? Now, again, you could keep your finger in the book of Genesis if you'd like. I'm going to bring into the picture here a reference from the book of Ezekiel many years later. But the prophet Ezekiel talks about this city of Sodom in Ezekiel 16, but we begin looking at verse 49. He's comparing, unfortunately, God's people to the city of Sodom. Ezekiel 16, verse 49, which says, behold, this was the guilt of your sister Sodom. She and her daughters had arrogance, abundant food, and careless ease. Now, I'm going to stop there in that verse. But you see the promise of Sodom there, don't you? The promise of Sodom is, if you live here, you can be proud of what we accomplish here, of what we have. Look, we have abundant food. You will never suffer lack. And it says careless ease. When do you have careless ease? When you got so much, you're carefree, and you don't have to worry about anything. That sounds like a great life, doesn't it? This is the promise of Sodom. Pride, excess of food, and prosperous ease. That's the words that the ESV uses. The trouble is that there is also sin in Sodom. So if you look at the rest of the verse, it says, but she did not help the poor and the needy. I'm also going to read verse 50. Thus they were haughty and committed abominations before me. In case we don't come back to this verse, look at the end of the verse as well, so you can see the end of Sodom. Therefore I removed them when I saw it. But let's focus for a second on these sins. The first sin mentioned is that she did not help the poor and needy. That's interesting. But that's exactly what happened the first time we see the interactions in Sodom. Because those same angelic messengers that had gone to Abraham to warn him about what God was doing to look in Sodom, got to Sodom. Now, this is the chance, right? This is the chance that Sodom has. The angels are here. All we need to do is show that there are 10 righteous people among us. And in fact, even if they didn't know they were angelic messengers, which I don't suppose they did, but when a person comes to your city, they are vulnerable, especially at that time. They should receive the kindest attention and hospitality. That's something that Abraham had given to those same men who came as angelic messengers in chapter 18. He rushed to put out the best kind of food that he had available for those people. Now, Lot, however, knew exactly the kind of treatment that these men were going to receive in Sodom. So now we've made our way to Genesis 19, and we can look at verses 1 through 3. The two angels came to Sodom in the evening as Lot was sitting in the gate of Sodom. When Lot saw them, he rose to meet them and bowed down with his face to the ground. And he said, now behold, my lords, please turn aside into your servant's house and spend the night and wash your feet. Then you may rise early and go on your way. Okay, so there's one righteous man, one who was showing the right attitude of hospitality. But they didn't come just to find one righteous man. They knew about Lot. The question is, how will everybody else in the city treat us? So they said, however, no, but we will spend the night in the square. Yet he urged them strongly. So they turned aside to him and entered into his house, and he prepared a feast for them and baked unleavened bread and they ate. You see how insistent Lot had to be. Lot was insistent because he knew the kind of treatment they were going to get. And it was not merely that they were going to have to go cold and hungry in the plaza at night. That would have been the best case scenario. Much worse things Lot knew the people of Sodom would do to these men. So were these people not caring for the needs of the poor? Correct. That's the first thing you see. But what else had Ezekiel said? Ezekiel said not only that, but they were haughty. Well, you're haughty or arrogant or full of pride because you don't care about the needs of others. You're also haughty when you refuse to recognize bounds. When you say no one can tell me what to do. No one's going to put a limit to my freedoms. No one but me is going to choose what I'm going to do. Which is, of course, a very, how would I put it, prevalent attitude that we see in our particular culture. Let's look at how they did not respect any bounds as we continue the reading in Genesis 19. This is verse 4. Before they lay down, the men of the city, the men of Sodom, surrounded the house, both young and old, all the people from every quarter. And they called to Lot and said to him, "Where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us that we may have relations with them." But Lot went out to them at the doorway and shut the door behind him and said, "Please, my brothers, do not act wickedly. Now behold, I have two daughters who have not had relations with man. Please bring them out to you and do to them whatever you like. Only do nothing to these men, inasmuch as they have come under the shelter of my roof." But they said, "Stand aside." Furthermore, they said, "This one came in as an alien, and already he's acting like a judge. But we will treat you worse than them." So they pressed hard against Lot and came near to break the door. But the men reached out their hands and brought Lot into the house with them and shut the door. And they struck the men who were at the doorway of the house with blindness, both small and great, so that they wearied themselves trying to find the doorway. Do you see some of the bounds that these men of Sodom are unwilling to recognize? And if you try and set a bound, it's almost a challenge to them to go even further just to show you that you will not stop them in what they want to do. First of all, there's the bound of reason. In verse 7, "Please, my brothers, do not act wickedly." That's tactful pleading and reason that they refuse to recognize. He says, try and consider the well-being of other people in verse 8. And yet they're unwilling to compromise even with the suggestion that Lot has, which, by the way, is a terrible suggestion. Shocking to me that Lot would even suggest it. He pushed it way far in a way that shocks me, and yet it did not even satisfy the people of Sodom and said, "That's not even enough. We want to go even further. We want to go to a greater level of perversion than what you are suggesting." Now, in verse 9, they said, "This one came in as an alien." Now, they were right about that, by the way, and Lot should have stayed as an alien. He should have stayed as a pilgrim. But they say, "This one came in as an alien. Already he's acting like a judge." That sounds like anything you've ever heard. Why are you judging me? Why are you such judgmental? That's the attitude of these men of Sodom. And when you think that someone sounds judgmental, they say, "You know what? I'm going to treat you even worse," says verse 9. So they press hard against Lot and came near to break the door. There's a physical barrier there. And a man trying to keep them from entering. But neither that man nor the physical barrier is going to restrain them in their wickedness. In fact, God blinds them. This is a supernatural blindness. But did they stop then? This is incredible to me. That when there is a divine restraint in their very bodies, they refuse to see it as anything but a challenge. And it says they wearied themselves trying to find a doorway in verse 11. Now, there's another text that talks about the people of Sodom. We're not going to go there necessarily unless you want to. Jude 7 says that they committed an abomination. What they're doing here is they have determined to commit an abomination, to press their lusts and perversions as far as it will go, and they will let nothing stop them. So sexual perversion and violent assault are coming together here in really just an awful scene. And it's hard for me to read it. It's hard to speak of. And we're certainly not going to talk about it in explicit ways here. So what did God do? You remember what Ezekiel 16 said? In verse 50, it said that he removed them. Now, that's kind of a light term, right? Jude talks about the punishment of eternal fire. The punishment of eternal fire. That's pretty literal, honestly. If you look at what happened with Sodom in chapter 19, verses 24 and 25, it says that the Lord rained on Sodom and Gomorrah, brimstone and fire from the Lord out of heaven. And He overthrew those cities and all the valley and all the inhabitants of the cities and what grew on the ground. Just yesterday, I read an article, and there's no certainty that this is the exact place where Sodom and Gomorrah were, but they have found evidence of a massive sudden heat that affected the elements in that place, in this area around this time of Abraham, in such a way that you could still recognize that it happened all at once. Now, the article attributed it to a meteor. I don't know, maybe God used a meteor here. But it's amazing to me that there is archaeological evidence, very possibly, of exactly what Scripture is talking about here. That fire from heaven has come down and consumed them and destroyed their land in a permanent way. To this very day, we can recognize it. So that city that promised so much security and wealth and ease, it ultimately delivered none of it. Nothing but fire that would consume everything that they had. What a deception. Now consider Lot. The testimony we have from 2 Peter 2 is that he was a God-fearing and a righteous man. And he was. He must have been so, but I'll tell you one thing he lacked was this pilgrim spirit that his uncle Abraham had. You see, when he first lifted up his eyes and he saw that beautiful valley, he surely was visualizing here is going to be a place of peace, of security, prosperity. But according to 2 Peter 2 verses 7 through 8, it says what he saw and heard was sensual conduct and lawless deeds that oppressed and distressed and tormented him. Now, it is evident that he was trying to reason with the people of Sodom as he lived there, that they cared nothing for his moral scruples. And when it got down to begging, please don't act so wickedly. When he tried to reason with them, and even compromise with them, none of it worked. You see, he tried to make Sodom his home, but because he was still clinging to the morality that he learned from God, he was never anything more than a foreigner to them. They said about him in Genesis 19 verse 9 that he was an alien living among them. So this is what happens when we test the middle ground. When we try to live in a godly way, but cozy up to the world, try and make it our home. That middle ground is never going to be a place of peace for us. The destruction of Sodom, as we read in Genesis 19, verses 24 and 25. That was something we would call cataclysmic. It was spectacular. But even worse, in a lot of ways, was the gradual buildup of judgment through corruption in Lot's own household. That was crushing. You see, his wife learned to love material things so much that when the angels were rescuing Lot and his family from the city of Sodom and they were fleeing, she could not bear to leave those possessions and she turned back with longing and she perished. Genesis 19:26. Now, even before that, as Lot and his family were trying to leave the household, Lot was trying to get his sons-in-law to come with him. You see, he had daughters, and his daughters married people of Sodom. And when he told them that the Lord is going to judge this city now, you know what they did? They left. Seemed like a joke to them. The idea of God possibly punishing people for what is wrong is a joke to them. That sounds like people of the world. So they stayed behind. And it doesn't end there with the wife and the sons-in-law. How about his daughters? Lot's daughters lived what they learned around them. Lot may have continued to be a righteous man, but his children did not fare so well because they indulged in similar perverted sexual behaviors to those around them. I say that because when Lot finally got away from the city in Genesis 19, verses 30 and following, let's look at verse 30. Lot went up from Zoar and stayed in the mountains, his two daughters with him, for he was afraid to stay in Zoar, and he stayed in a cave, he and his two daughters. Now what happens in that cave is a shameful thing. His two daughters decide that we need to have children. There's only one man here. So they commit incest with their father and impregnate themselves by him. So Lot himself, how about him? Now, it is sad to me the grip that the world had on him. You see that Lot himself lingered when the angels are trying to get him to go away. Verse 16 of Genesis 19 says that Lot hesitated. So the men seized his hand and the hand of his wife and the hand of the two daughters, for the compassion of the Lord was upon him, and they brought him out and put him outside the city. He practically has to be dragged from the place that he was so committed to. He's only escaping because the Lord was merciful. Now, the second time, the angels had to lay their hands on him. The first time, Lot was trying to block the door from these men who were trying to enter into it so that they could violate God's messengers who were with him in the house. They had to pull him in from the door. They rescued him that time, and the second time, they had to basically drag him out of the city so that Lot would not get caught up in the same destruction as the rest of the city. Now, when he gets out, he started begging the angels. Now, this is in verses 17 through 20. What happens is that Lot decided that he wanted to stay in a nearby city. We saw that he was in Zoar in verse 30. That's the city that he wanted to stay in. A quote from Derek Kidner. Derek Kidner says of this moment that not even brimstone will make a pilgrim of him. Not even brimstone. In other words, he doesn't want to go back to the tent lifestyle. He wants to stay in a city. Even as he sees fire raining from heaven to destroy the city of Sodom, he says, let me stay in Zoar. It's just a small city. But we saw already, didn't we, in verse 30, said that finally he was afraid even to stay in Zoar. He ends up living the rest of his life in fear, and he ends up living in a cave with his daughters. A cave! So much for handing in his tents so that he could live in a permanent home. I think the last happy day in his life was the day he decided to leave Abraham. He was miserable for the rest of his life as he pursued that kind of lifestyle of trusting in what his eyes saw. Because all he ever found afterwards was first war, then even in the times of peace his soul was tormented, then there was destruction. Cataclysmic destruction. After that, his life was full of fear. And in the end, he lost custody even of his body. For his daughters followed the ways of Sodom, plotted to get him drunk, and in that state is when they impregnated themselves by him. There were a couple children that resulted from that relationship, we can call it that. The children were Moab and Ammon. Those of you who have read the Old Testament before may recognize those names, Moab and Ammon. Moab and Ammon were thorns in the side of the people of Israel many years into the future, for centuries. For they grew into nations that, in the case of Moab, seduced the people into carnal sin, Numbers 25, cruel religious practice. Leviticus 18:21 talks about the God of Ammon who demanded child sacrifices, and the people of Israel would sometimes follow in that. Have I painted a picture, a miserable picture of what resulted from Lot's choice? All of it resulted from this self-centered choice that he made to have well-watered pasture lands for himself. I say it started there, didn't it? As he lifted up his eyes and cared more about that. But didn't he make that choice over and over again? Every day of his life that he stayed there was him making that choice again and again. Lot was foolish to place his faith in the worldly promises of Sodom. Abraham was wise to trust in God's promises. We see him in the final scene here in Genesis 19. He's surveying what has happened. In verses 27 and 28, Abraham arose early in the morning, went to the place where he had stood before the Lord. That's his place of intercession. And he looked down toward Sodom and Gomorrah, and toward all the land of the valley, and he saw, and behold, the smoke of the land ascended like the smoke of a furnace. What do you think he was probably thinking as he looked at that? I made the right choice to trust in God, to trust in His promises and live by faith. Brethren, friends, what has God told you about what's going to happen to this world? It's going to be destroyed in fire. 2 Peter 3, verse 7. It will burn in judgment. So if God sends His messengers to you and says, escape, 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 just the way those angelic messengers had said to Lot, don't resist. Don't linger. Don't hesitate. If God is grabbing your hand, that's His mercy. Don't resist its pull. So if you're not a Christian, then today's call is to join this band of pilgrims that we have. People who live by faith, who don't belong here, whose citizenship, says Philippians 3, is in heaven. You can do that by repenting of your sins, leaving them behind, and being baptized into Christ. Those are two things that, for instance, Acts 2:38, among many other passages, would encourage you to do. And you can receive forgiveness of sins, and you can become one of God's band of pilgrims. But with a couple minutes that I may have remaining, with your patience, I just want to talk to Christians real quick. Don't be deceived by the short-term appearances. When the world sees a man who is well-adjusted in this world socially, who is prosperous, successful, powerful, with influence, who says, no one can tell me what to do. It seems that person has freedom and strength, and no one can tell them no. What is the truth of that? That person is on the edge of destruction, and no one in the world may recognize it. But that's the truth. When the world looks at you, making decisions that don't make sense, behaviors that don't make sense, refusing things that they say are good, refusing to participate in things that they say are fun, they look at you and they see someone who is weak, who is strange, who is intolerant. So what do? They react sometimes with hostility towards us, sometimes with derision and just make fun of us. But the truth is that the pilgrim spirit that we're talking about, that Abraham, a faith that says, I'm not of this place, powerful. Let me tell you some of the things that it will help you to do and give you the strength to do. Number one, be holy without shame. That's a wonderful power because you can avoid the degradation and the shame of the things that the world participates in. So many things, so many traps, so many pitfalls that we can avoid if we live as those who are citizens of heaven. I tell you, it will also give us bravery as we show faith by putting at risk some things that we have in the world. We may put at risk our worldly status. We may put at risk our worldly profits. We may put at risk even our health, all to prioritize spiritual things. I think we as Christians have a resource the world simply does not have during this pandemic, because we recognize our earthly bodies merely as tents here. It will give us strength to be able to behave differently. I regret and have had to repent of some ways that I behaved during the pandemic that did not show faith, because I let the Lord's work suffer in some ways. There were Bible studies I did not have with people who needed to hear the Word of God. There was hospitality that needed to be done that I didn't do. There was affection that needed to be shown that I didn't do. This living as a pilgrim in faith is going to help us, even in this moment of crisis in our culture. Our culture has doubled down on their faith in science. This is the motto that we keep hearing. Let's double down on our